I don't know if you've listened to my podcast before, but sometimes there's a bit of explicit language, and this is one of those times. It's Friday, December 1st, 2017. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. And today, December 1st, today is the day that Donald Trump became president. Well, more accurately, today is the day why most of the Republicans in the House and the Senate put up with the fact that Donald Trump became president. It looks like they are getting their tax bill. Also, given the Mike Flynn plea deal, today is also the day Donald Trump's path to no longer being president became pretty clear. Flynn flipped to get someone bigger, someone close to the president, like a son or a son-in-law. Look, I do not know. I don't expect Trump to be deposed by judicial intervention, but this could complicate his life. So on the same day, the Senate gives him a legislative achievement for the first time, and it's an actual achievement, this happens. Now, the tax bill is not progressive. It certainly won't pay for itself. It probably will exacerbate income inequality. But it could also provide economic stimulus, of course, probably will. And there are provisions that would let a lot of Trump voters feel that he and the Republican Party were delivering on what they promised, giving them some more money in the pocket. And that's why you participate in politics in the first place. You don't stay invested for long just because the president shares some of your outrages and does it on Twitter. There's a lot of people who could do that for you, all right? That's a angry AM radio host. You don't need the president year after year for that. That's junk food. That's not nourishment. For all the criticisms of this tax bill as a giveaway to the wealthy or written under darkness, it is, when you think about it, really in lockstep with Republican philosophy. We do have two parties in this country. One of them is the Republican Party. They're, in fact, the more successful electorally. So you would think that when the Republicans do what they promised for the people who vote for Republicans, it will have good electoral consequences. And Trump really needed it. Before he was elected, his wildly veering from subject to subject, that might have had a curious appeal. A voter might say to himself or herself, but statistically himself, voter might say to himself, well, why not take a chance? But if he didn't show that he was actually delivering benefits, no amount of tweeting would be able to save him. And by the way, we have seen that tested. We have seen all amount of tweeting. This bill, this is a mainstream consensus wish list of the conservative movement, no matter what you think of it, was necessary for Trump's future agenda. Necessary, but not sufficient. He will have to avoid international calamity. He will have to hope the economy continues to perform well. And he will have to, of course, avoid prosecution. And he'll also have to ignore that angry, growling voice inside of him that's yelling, "Fire Mueller! Fire Mueller!" That won't be easy for Mr. Trump. On the show today, it is an Antan Twig. We award lop stars. But first, he is a stand-up comedian and a legendary TV dad. Bob Sackett gladly sat down for this interview, but as you can tell, he has no real use for interviewers. I don't mean he has disdain. I mean, like a dog has no use for wall art. Even if he notices it, it doesn't really distract him from his business. With this in mind, here's Bob Sackett, and at times, me. If Then is a podcast about technology, society, and power. Power! Raw power! On this week's If Then, Slate's April Glazer and Will Arimus discuss how bots messed up the net neutrality comment process and whether that gives advocates a last chance to preserve an open internet. If Then, I've been enjoying it. Perhaps you will too. If you do, then let us know.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan, but nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
Bob Saget, he's a noted actor, comedian. He was on this sitcom once, according to his credits, Full Something. Not really familiar with that piece of work.
Yep, exactly.
He is now out with a new special, and we're going to talk about his whole career and where he and comedy stands right now. Hello, Bob. How are you?
I'm really good. I feel like we haven't talked until this moment.
Yeah. It feels like we just sat down, and I started reading an intro, and you were like, this is not normal human conversation, but I'll go for it.
I like it. I'm a pro. This is not my first rodeo. That's actually the first thing we said to each other.
I like the idea of callbacks to things that the audience can't possibly get.
Well, that's what I love about Carson and Letterman. You got a lot of something happened right before.
Yeah.
They would say, oh, that lady in the fifth row, that woman from Des Moines. And it was literally for
right.
the studio audience.
You know, right. Letterman will say, I don't know, maybe you're a podiatrist from Dubuque. And the audience goes crazy. Like, is this funny? I don't understand why this is funny.
We'll find out more from Mary later. And Mary only talks during commercial breaks.
Yeah. So I want to ask you about a specific joke, and you would say it often when you would do panel on talk shows. There'd be a string of rapid-fire jokes that made sense to me, and then you would say, and tell me if I'm getting it wrong, my mother's Pokey, my father's Gumby, and I'm a Winnebago.
No, you're so close,
Did
and
I
it's amazing.
Oh,
no, you didn't. No, you're on it. You're on it. You're honoring me to a point you wouldn't know. My first 5 minutes, I wrote in a law library in Cornell because my girlfriend, who became my ex-wife, became my wife.
There's a period in between.
We cut out the middle. So we just went right to ex-wife.
That's good.
Yeah, it's easy. There's no prenup. But
prenup. During the dating experience, just, you know, give her 20% and move on. Yeah.
That was, dreaming.
20.
What's 20 mean? That was the dating age after we left each other. But that was 20 years ago we got divorced. More than that, we have three beautiful kids. I have a fiance now. First time that means something wonderful to me in my six relationships. I'm a pretty noble guy, actually, as much as and that's where the bawdiness comes from.
You got to get someone else to say that, though. That's the problem.
No, but yeah, because it means I'm guilty.
Yeah.
I've done things.
A pretty noble guy. Okay.
I've done things. It's weird to talk about yourself and say, and it is kind of wrong to go, I'm a good guy. I'm a noble guy, you know, but that can bite you in the butt because you're saying, I've never done anything, and I've done some dumb things. I wrote a book called Dirty Daddy, and in it I had a chapter, Relationships I'd Rather Not Talk About, and another one called Things I Shouldn't Have Done. And that's like drunk driving and stuff. And that's that you don't do. You can kill people. But we're in a world right now where misogyny is, it's just, it all started with the grab on Access Hollywood, and it kind of became this male howling at the moon and how guys can have this locker room talk. And it ain't locker room talk. Because there are people that follow through that have problems. But I can't say anybody's done in this world when our president is Donald Trump, because he's been finished many times.
Yeah.
He's been bankrupt. He's come back. And he's the president of the United States. And there's probably stuff on him that is just completely smeared over that we don't know about. There's probably stuff on a ton of people. I mean, we're finding out right now, you know, people that are out criticizing people and they've got a 14-year-old boy in their closet. And he's next to a steamer, so at least he's not wrinkled. See, that's not an appropriate joke.
That's wrong. That would be wrong.
But that's wrong.
And
but my,
you know what,
intention,
my laughter,
if you quote that, if you quote that, it's disgusting.
Yeah.
If you say it and someone hears it, they could go, I'm not listening to this crap. Or, oh, he didn't mean anything by that because he's just trying to get through it.
Yeah, but what you laid out, it just means I've now had a third of the audience of what I started, just so you know.
Do you think so?
No, I don't. But
I watch one of my favorites.
The three choices are not listen, protest, or keep listening.
I'm not even that dirty. I was watching a Family Guy in South Park recently. It's like the same tone.
Yeah.
It's just, I had one joke about I got to be careful here, but I had one joke in the special, which is true. I was like in Canada and Winnipeg, and I had a medical problem, and it was frozen, and it was in my posterior, and I'm saying that it broke off because it was so cold, and that a squirrel got a hold of it. Now that's kind of a PG-13 thing what I just said, but. And then some people said, you can't say that. That's terrible. That's filthy.
The answer to that, if it could fly, has a lot to do with the framing and the format, because for all, I'm not talking about actual physical, tangible transgressions, Louis Bill Cosby, Harvey Weinstein. I'm talking about people getting upset at remarks.
I'm not familiar. What did Harvey do?
Yeah, just everything. Like, imagine it. It was all of it. My point is that for all the comments that get protested, there are tons of stuff going on either under the radar or on, you know, morning radio or on the podcast I listen to or in certain genres of speech or movies that no one gives a damn about. So it's all like what we choose to pay attention to. And to some extent, we're primed to get a little upset. That certain segments of our society get off on that.
I could use somebody not making fun of other people. That's what I could use. And I know that there's people that are evil in the world that want to hurt people, but we shouldn't be those people. We're here to unify and have a good time. And if you don't want it, you can get your money back, and I'm sorry, and take off, because I'm not going to have a fight. I just want to have a good time. I really have become Liza Minnelli. I want to entertain people. I really, really do. And I think...
And they look to you for a catharsis. That's what you're providing.
This is the weird part. And you mentioned it at the top. I was Danny Tanner. While I was doing the video show, and which was before YouTube, which meant if you wanted to see someone get hit in the nuts, you had to go through me. Not even on sports compilation.
You're the gatekeeper.
I was the gatekeeper of blooper ball hits. And I am proud of that. And I'm proud of, but you're not proud of it while you're working 90 hours a week, making a lot of money, complaining, which is, who wants to know that person?
Yeah.
Not me. So I went through a lot of therapy and grew up. You know, actors complain if they're working or not working.
Yes.
I try not to when I'm working because I've been on the other side. It's not my first rodeo. That's the catchphrase for this interview.
So you do these two shows that are absolutely beloved, but obviously we know where your comedy is and the comedy you want to be doing, and we know the level of comedy on those shows, which isn't to say it's bad. It's just pitched to a different audience and not one you're totally into. Do you think that took a little out of you? Beyond the 90 hours, the fact that you were giving so much to this art form that wasn't exactly what you wanted to
be doing. All the fun that I had was in both shows, there was a lot of fun to be had. Mm-hmm. The stuff in between a lot of the dialogue, just playing and acting crazy, acting like 9-year-old boys, Dave, John, and I had a really good time.
Right.
And that's why there's love between the kids and us. And it's just pure love. I'm here in New York. I'm going to see Ashley. I want to see Mary Kate. You know, I mean, and they're not on the show. Oh, big news story. You know, the show was made for 14-year-old girls. It wasn't meant for 50-year-old critics to say, I don't like this show. You know, it's not that show. It was a two-dimensional show with morality plays that were necessary for a lot of people. More people know me from that, I think, around the world. We just went to Japan. I mean, it's all over the world. Than anything, because they grew up watching it. There was sometimes a certain hipness to it. Something weird was going on between the lines. But it was pretty much, you know, don't bring a horse in the living room. Don't drink beer at the prom. Music comes in on synthesizers. And people think I'm like that character.
Yeah.
And I wanted to be a clean freak, and I wanted to hug people. But I didn't want to wear cardigan sweaters, which someone who's very guilty wore them all the time. And how can I be cynical or not appreciative when a mother comes up to me and says, I raised my kids by myself and because my husband left or died. And same with fathers saying it about my wife died. And they said, you helped me talk to my kids. You opened up issues. And they weren't the issues from the show, because some of ours were a little lame. But some of them were very real. Like, mom died, came up, and we talked about it.
But I bet none of those families brought a horse into the house either.
No, they didn't. And that horse became fodder for a lot of inappropriate humor.
Yeah. And then he became glue.
He did. No, never glued him.
No.
No animals were harmed permanently. Only during the shooting. People say to me, before a show, before a special, before anything, are you going to be funny tonight? And that's, don't say that to a comedian. It's like saying to your pilot, are you going to get me to Cleveland? It's like saying to your brain surgeon, am I dead? You know, are you going to, I don't know. Let me just work on your brain.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I've been doing this.
You going to tune that guitar, Bruce? Yeah,
right.
I think I will.
Or people always say, do you have a tuner? And it's like, I got a phone. I got a tuner. So I've been doing stand-up since I'm 17. So, I mean, that's crazy. 43 years of stand-up is nuts.
Yeah.
And I did more stories in 0 to 60 than I have ever done. 0 to 60 means I'm gone from 0 years old to 60 years old. And then I got the remake ripoff of the North by Northwest poster. This was the first time it's ever been released this way. This is not a Netflix show. It's on iTunes and Amazon in a big way. You know, they're putting banner ads and all that crap.
Yeah.
But it's also on Google Play and AT&T. It's on over 100 whatever the platforms,
yeah,
all over the world. So there is no way to avoid it if you want to see it.
Even in Canada.
Even in Canada. That's the thing I got to fix because somebody said, I can't get it in Canada. You know you're doing what my joke is. You know you're doing what my joke is. That's a comedian. I have said before.
Well, you don't want to say it in conversations and pretend this is just something that's flowing out of you naturally. Yeah.
Right.
To quote the great Bob Saget, Bob Saget says.
And you got
to
say it in third person. Yeah. I say it myself. To quote the great Bob Saget, and then it's then I'm talking in third person.
But if you're actually on stage, you say, it just happened to me, or just on the way over. It's,
oh
my God. It's 180 degrees of truthfulness.
You do, however, say I just flew in from. That yeah. is never a lie. I just got in from, and I couldn't believe it, that the turbulence and the bathroom and the people and this baby and, okay, enough. We know you travel.
So, Bob, you're sitting in the Cornell Law Library.
Yep.
And here we get back to why is my mother.
My first joke, yes. not a joke.
Yes.
So the first thing that I said in the law library was I have no friends and I have no life and I live in a moped. And that is nothing but rhythm.
Yes.
And absurdity.
Mm-hmm.
I had no friends growing up. I moved from, I did have friends. That's not true. But all of my energy wasn't into friendships. I didn't have parties. I didn't go to parties. I went to one concert. I was like complete nerd burglar. And then at 22 in LA, I just kind of let it rip and just became part of that early 80s scene with all these people. So I was like a kid that went to Pleasure Island rather than go to my graduate school at USC, which would have made me a horror director by
yeah
20 years ago. But it was all worth it because I kept doing so many different things. And then I came up with jokes that were way ahead of their time at about 18 that were in the area we're in now. There was a senator that was in the newspaper, and I was sometimes topical because I was so outraged, so I would go into absurdity. There was a senator who had allegedly had relations with a 14-year-old boy, and that just sounds a little familiar right now. And my joke was, I was 18. My mother never let me go to camp as a kid because she thought I'd get embarrassed undressing in front of little boys, but I've changed a lot because I kind of like it now. And then I said, that's not true. I like it a lot. And then I said, that's not true. I'm not a senator. So it got to a relevant place,
good.
And it's a three-stepper.
Yeah.
I always would do three-step jokes, and now I just kind of go, set up, joke. You know, Bob, there's a middle step. No, I'm sorry. I work alone. But so I get more jokes crammed in. In an hour.
But you have to bust those jokes. You can't open a set with them. They have to get to know you a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's the advantage. That's the difference about my life at 61 than it's ever been. People get all the different sides of me, which makes it very easy for me to try to grow. And now the stepping off point for me, 0 to 60 is a special I wish I'd done 25 years ago so that
the name wouldn't have made sense.
No, but 0 to 40, because Secret of Life is 42, according to the
Life, the Universe, and Everything.
Oh,
Doug Adams.
Oh, such good stuff. Really good. And it was for me. Unfortunately, though, I got divorced around then, so that it was complicated. But I guess it's when you go, aha, I want this to be different. And it was the right, nothing's ever right. Things always hurt, but you get through them. And comedy has been, the audience has been my friend. It's a true relationship. And Seinfeld says it pretty eloquently. You know, it's a discourse.
Bob Saget's new special, 0 to 60, is apparently on every platform in America, Canada, and throughout the world. Thank you so much. Great to meet you.
Really great to meet you. I'll see you at your home later.
Okay, good. Thanks. This episode is brought to you by the Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about the Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where it got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of The Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for The Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters in hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And now the spiel. Hi, Mike. Got this email. Hi, Mike. As the winter approaches, individuals in New York can stop by and grab a few lightly used hoodies and goodies for the family to prepare for the cold winter months. It's Hoodies for the Homeless, and they're opening their first ever pop-up store, and they've named the store For the Greater Hood, to which I say, oh, Jesus. The Salvation Army says that, too, and they provide clothes for the homeless, but I really mean it. Oh, Jesus, this is how we're going to solve homelessness via the hipster's favorite garment, the hoodie. I was thinking maybe housing would work. Maybe that would be housing for the homeless, but they went with hoodies. They went with hoodies for the homeless. Because when I see a homeless guy, I say, you know, that guy needs to dress more like Bill Belichick. And then again, when I see Bill Belichick, I say, how does that homeless guy have so many Super Bowl titles? From the makers of adult rompers for the Rohingya, it's hoodies for the homeless. And because we were casting about for another annoyingly trendy buzzword and claymation was taken, we've got a pop-up store. A pop-up store supplying hoodies for the homeless. Next week, the store will be bottling local kombucha to ship to disaster zones. So that's what I got an email about today. I get plenty of emails and Facebook posts and tweets, and I like to check in on them from time to time. Every 3 weeks, in fact. And that is why we call it the Antan twig. It is the old English word for 21. 21 days, like a fortnight is 14 days. So every 3 weeks. Pierre, when was the last time we did this?
It was September 29th.
So that was actually 2 months ago.
It's over 2 months ago.
Well, we're talking about September and November. Those are those kind of lame 30-month days. So it was 62 days ago. It should be two normal months. But yeah, I get it. Wasn't 3 weeks. So I guess that's my first correction. And my second correction is this. I said Beethoven's ninth. I meant Beethoven's fifth. That was wrong. I also should have been more specific. I meant Dave Beethoven. I was talking about his limericks. The ninth is the best. A few people wrote me about this. On a Friday the 13th, possibly in one of those lame 30-day months, I was saying, oh, people are always so taken by Friday the 13th. I mean, what are the chances? And I said, yeah, it's 1 in 7. If it's the 13th of the month, 1 in 7 of those will be Fridays. And Yellen writes in to say, actually, under the Gregorian calendar, which repeats every 400 years, we will have 688 Friday the 13th, while we have only 687 Wednesday the 13th and 684 Thursday the 13th. Friday the 13th is the most common 13th of the month. The odds are 1 in 6.98. And I would have been really disgusted, except he signs off, nitpickingly yours, Frank Yellen. I guess I was edified by that. As much as I bristle at a correction, I said 7, I meant 6.98. But it was good. Now I learned. Joan Loring writes in, I was talking about Sarah Huckabee Sanders and her argument that, well, nothing the president did should be held against him because the American people certainly voted for him. And I pointed out, well, they didn't, not most of them, and most people voted for someone else. And also, why, you're actually saying that that is the referendum on the ethical acts that he took just because he won the non-popular vote? And Joan writes in saying she doesn't even think that Sanders was arguing that. She took Sanders' argument to mean that most Trump voters actually knew about Trump's sexual assault allegations, believed them, and voted for them anyway. When she says the people have spoken, they processed it, and they were like, okay with that. Huh. I don't know. I guess there's just no amount of speculating about what Sarah Huckabee Sanders really means or what she thinks good arguments are. So I'll buy your theory, Joan. Dave Valliette, I don't know, maybe a cousin of Bob Saget co-star Dave Coulier. Dave Valliette writes, Mr. Pesca, good, off to a good foot. I would like to suggest a better framing for the ending of your gambler's fallacy episode. So the gambler's fallacy is thinking you're due. Like you're playing roulette and red keeps coming up and then you think, oh, we're due to hit green. That is the gambler's fallacy. But he rightly notes, but if you're talking about a deck of cards and you keep going through the cards and you get a whole bunch of red ones, black actually does come up more often towards the end of the pack. I know I made explicitly clear that we were talking about variations of a game of chance where the odds reset each time. So getting a black card, then you'd put the black card in the deck. He contrasts the deck of cards where you don't replace it to the roulette wheel, which of course is fresh odds every time. And he says, in life, you rarely know if you have been presented with a metaphorical stack of cards or a metaphorical roulette wheel. Drinks on table 9, but In another segment where I was talking to Maria Konnikova, because the last email was about a Konnikova segment, Thomas Catron writes in about the subject of being scared to death. And he alerts me to something called Takotsubo cardiomyopathy, which is a presumed sudden surge resulting in atypical cardiac dysfunction. The full physiology is still murky, and it's rare to die from it, but it happens. You can get scared to death. And here's what grabbed me with this. The reason it's called Takotsubo cardiomyopathy is that Takotsubo is apparently a Japanese word for a type of octopus trap, which is shaped like a narrow-necked pot, because that's what the heart looks like when affected. Actually, maybe that's what causes most of the mortality. It's not the actual event. It's just being told afterwards by your cardiologist. Well, we have the x-rays, and your heart looks exactly like an octopus chest. Puts down the scungili. Why were you eating scungili in the doctor's office? John Cork writes in, this is my segment where I talked to the author of Was the Cat in the Hat Black? Talking about the racial implications of Dr. Seuss. He has an interpretation. As someone who has read The Cat in the Hat as a child, and to my own son, the question of race does not address the central notion of the story, which is, there is no cat. There are only two kids left at home on a rainy day who break the rules and argue about the rules. They both pretend to be the cat and thing one and thing two and try to clean up the messes they make. And when asked by their mother what they did, they will likely lie through their teeth. He also says there were no wild things and Peter T. Hooper does not go to any real foreign land to collect eggs. What's next? Clifford the Big Red Dog was actually Brad Pitt all along talking to himself? What are you telling me? Harold really was the purple crayon? And Judy Blooms, are you there, God? It's me, Margaret. Are you saying there is no God? Are you saying there is no Margaret? But thanks for the literary interpretation, John Cork. And now comes time to award the Lobstar of the Antan Twig. And I'm going to award this to a listener who wrote in after I went kind of nuts about the practice of spilling your hot coffee into the trash at Starbucks just for a little room for milk. And Taylor Aiken writes in and says, Mike, I can hear how upset you are. I used to be that way too. Upset in general? I don't know. Please let me help. I asked for room for milk, but got a cup totally full. So I asked the barista by the milk and sweetener hub, you know the hub, if she'd pour a little out into the sink behind the counter. And she says, oh, that's okay. You could just dump it in the trash. This is a barista-endorsed activity. I guess that makes me feel a little better. And that is why the Lobstar of this Antan Twig is Taylor Aiken's barista. And that's it for today's show. Whatever happened to predictability? The milkman, the paper boy, just producer Pierre Bien-Aimé. I know it's Bien-Aimé, but come on, rhyme scheme, people. It's like just producer Mary Wilson likes to say while crossing the Golden Gate Bridge, everywhere you look, everywhere you go, there's a face of somebody who needs you. When you're lost and you're all alone, a light is waiting to carry you home, and that light is a kerosene lamp carried by Steve Diogenes Lichtai, executive producer of Slate Podcasts. The Gist. My mother's Snagglepuss, my father's Bjorn Nitmo, and I once ate a Muppet for sport. Peru, and thanks for listening.